Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
All right, time to get the show on the road here. It's Sunday, the 6th of July, and it's about 7:30 in the morning here in Rome, Italy. A hot one in Rome. It's been hot the last two weeks or so. Just constant sunshine and 90 plus temperatures, around 32 to 33 for you folks on the more modern system. And we've got the air conditioner running. More on the air conditioning in a minute, because it has been causing us some technical difficulties here in the shack. They're kind of interesting, and I'll talk about them. A little bit of our Italy travelogue here, because folks say they like this. We were at the beach on the 4th of July. In Rome, you can get to the beach quite easily, and there's some nice beaches fairly close by, within a half hour or an hour of town. This is a real benefit for us, because take the kids to the beach and let them jump in the water a little bit. It's a real nice part of life in Rome, and especially when the temperatures are getting up where they've been here the last week or so. Temperatures in the shack. This brings us to the latest rage here at Italy Zero Stroke N2CQR, and that is, as you guys have been hearing, I think some of you probably been hearing too much of, QRSS, slow speed CW, low and slow. I have been afflicted with this new variety of the knack and interest in low speed, low power CW. You really have to have the knack to get interested in this kind of thing. I try every once in a while to explain it to my wife, and she's really, really good at least feigning interest and amazement at my technical adventures and achievements. But I got to say that the QRSS thing, even for her, it's kind of hard to even feign interest and amazement. It is kind of a specialized activity, but those of us with the knack understand it, and I'm sure you guys can all understand what I'm talking about here. Let me just review. I now have a 50 milliwatt crystal controlled transmitter on or about 10.140060. I'll say that again, 10.140060 hertz. 10 megahertz, 0.140060. We're down to hertz here in the QRSS world, and that's where my beacon is operating. It's just a really simple crystal controlled oscillator. I have a little trimmer cap between the crystal and ground that lets me wiggle the frequency a bit, because that is necessary in the QRSS world. After the crystal oscillator, I have two Class A feedback amps that bring the power output up to 50 milliwatts. I had it at 200 milliwatts, but that was way too QRO, way too high power for the QRSS gang. The QRSS community, and it is a real community, is built around a mailing list known as the Knights, Knights with a K, like King Arthur and those guys. And they are, I joked with them the other day that it's an appropriately named group, because they're a real group of gentlemen, and they're very fine business radio amateurs willing to help out a newcomer. And so just check them out. They're easy to find on the internet, and QRSS Knights, and you'll find the information about how to sign up for the mailing list and get involved. let me tell you about the latest adventures. I think in the last show I talked about my problems in calibration. For QRSS, the window, I guess the band of QRSS operation is only 100 hertz wide. So guys who are listening for your signal are only going to be listening between 10.140.000 and 10.140.100 on the 30 meter band. There's activity on other bands, but I think most of it is on 30 meters. Anyway, you've got to get your signal in that window, or nobody is going to hear you or really see you, is because it's all kind of visual. You'd think that having a crystal of the appropriate frequency would be enough. In other ham radio activities, crystal control is seen as pretty much the most kind of the standard for determining where your frequency is. But well, crystal control is not quite enough in QRSS, because any kind of variation in the circuit parameters, as we know, will move the frequency a little bit. This is the principle behind all of our variable crystal oscillators. And that variable bit will easily move you out of the band. So my early challenges with QRSS were getting in the band. And I was complaining about this, whining a bit, I think, in the last issue of Solder Smoke. But then right after Solder Smoke, I figured out how to do it. And what happened was I was able to find, by listening in my Drake 2B, I was able to find a standard CW beacon here in Italy that was of a known frequency. And I don't have the guy's call sign here, but he's got a good beacon, and it was on the air, and it was fairly close to the QRSS frequency range. And what I did was I fired up this spectrum analysis software called Argo, and which is available free for free download on the net. Fired up Argo. And then I tuned my Drake 2B receiver after letting it heat up for a while to get stable. I tuned the Drake 2B until I could see in the waterfall display from Argo the beacon. Okay, so now I knew what that frequency was on the screen, and I knew that to be in the QRSS band, I had to be, I think, 1,750 hertz below that beacon station. I think we knew exactly what the beacon, or more or less what the beacon frequency was for that that Italian beacon. Anyway, I turned on my beacon transmitter, and with the little trimmer cap, I just, looking at the screen on the computer, adjusted my frequency to be 1,750 hertz below the frequency of the Italian CW beacon. And man, there you go. Voila. Eureka. Eccolo. It worked. I started looking at the grabbers. And this is the beautiful part of QRSS work. You can let other people work on the receive systems. With my Drake 2B here, I'm really not well set up. I hate to talk bad about the Drake 2B, but it's not really made for this kind of thing. It suffers from dial parallax, as we discussed last week or last episode. But it doesn't matter, because there are other radio amateurs out there, knights, all of them, who have set up what are known as grabbers. And grabbers are really just online displays of the computer output of the sound card programs, usually Argo or Spectran, that will display on the computer screen what is coming through their receivers into their sound cards. And it's displayed with, it's calibrated for frequency, And at a glance, when you look at one of these grabbers, you could see everything in the frequency window that we're interested in. So I knew that if propagation was at all good, I would start showing up on... There's a grabber up in northern Italy by I2NDT, Claudio. He has a really good grabber. And there's another one up in Belgium, ON5EX by Johan. And I know both of these grabbers are very sensitive, and I know that 30 is usually open in that direction during daylight hours at least. But anyway, after I got this, after I got my calibration thing squared away, right away I started seeing my CW scrolling across the bottom of Claudio's grabber screen. It wasn't pretty. I mean, the CW, one thing about QRSS is that all of the imperfections of your signal become not only audible, but visible. I think visible is worse, because it's like hanging out there all for everybody to see right on the screen. If you've got a little bit of chirp, your dashes will droop. If you've got clicks, they will just spike up from the beginning and ends of your dots and dashes. And at various points in the last couple of weeks, I've had both clicks and chirp. My chirp at first was useful because it made my signal kind of easy to identify. I was the guy with the droopy dashes, or I think Johan put it, Italian tears. It looked like they looked kind of sad. But anyway, I was very pleased to get in the to be visible in the grabbers, and for the first time in my ham radio life, to be a real milliwatter. I am a milliwatter. None of these full watts. None of these this QRO stuff for me now. It's milliwatts, and I have to say that the 200 milliwatts that I was running at the start, well, they're a nice bunch of fellas, but it raised some eyebrows in the QRSS world. I was seen as being a borderline watt hog, ether smasher. Anyway, I had to lower the power a little bit. More on that in a second. The grabber thing, the grabber system is really terrific. You can get an instantaneous kind of instantaneous feedback on how your signal is doing, where it's being received. And this brings me to the next level of this adventure. Once you have these things on, once you put on your beacon or your MEPT, your manned experimental propagation transmitter, as we call them, you could check on your progress from anywhere. So if the thing is on and you are at another computer anywhere in the world, you or anyone else in the world can take a look at, for example, Johan's grabber and see how my signal is doing into the grabber at any given time. If you went there right now, you'd see it. It's transmitting as I speak. I look up and my 50 milliwatts are going out. Here's another thing. I've been telling you that because of work, I'm now walking around with a BlackBerry. Well, yeah, you see what I'm talking about. I could be, and I did this. I've got the beacon on. It's transmitting. I'm riding to work on the number 63 bus going through Central Rome, right through the heart of Central Rome, right past Piazza Venezia. Right as the bus comes around the corner, I can see the Colosseum off to the right, heading up the Corso, heading towards work. And I say, hey, I wonder how my 50 milliwatt beacon is making it over the Alps right now. Let me check out Johan's grabber. So I pull out the BlackBerry, click, click, click. The next thing you know, the familiar screen of Johan's grabber appears right on my screen right there on the 63 bus, and I can see that line. I could see that little line there right around 140.10.140.060, and that's me. Those are my CW characters being received on the other side of Europe. 50 milliwatts making it over the Alps Johann's FT-1000 into his sound card, through his spectrum analysis program, onto his screen, out onto the internet, back to me through this BlackBerry cell phone system and onto my screen on the 63 bus. Guys, I think that's kind of neat. I think those of you, I feel bad about afflicting you with this kind of this kind of ham radio addiction, especially at the beginning of the summer when you should be doing other things. But man, I tell you, it's just it's really amazing stuff. It appeals to the QRP-er in all of us. It appeals to the home brewer, to the CW guy. It's got a lot to offer. So I am really surprised that there seems to be relatively little QRSS activity in the U.S. This seems to be much more of a European thing. Hans Summers in the U.K. was leading the charge on this for a long time and has done really amazing work and has some great websites with all kinds of information up there. There are grabbers all over Europe, but we only see a few grabbers in the U.S. We have grabbers also in all around the world. There are Australian grabbers, and Lawrence or Flo, KL1X, has a really excellent grabber system at his current location in Singapore. And I'm really waiting for Lawrence to report that he's picked up my signal, or for me to see my signal on his grabber, because it's on the net. I've got, if you're trying to visualize what I'm talking about, I put all kinds of information, all kinds of links to the grabbers, all kinds of screenshots of the grabbers receiving my signal. They're all on my blog at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Real simple. You don't even need the www. Just http://soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's really a lot of fun, and it provides for instant feedback. You instantly know how your signal is because you can see it right there on the screen. The droopy dashes, you know, at first it was kind of distinctive. It made it easy for me to spot my signal even when you couldn't quite read all the CW characters. When the dashes were drooping, I knew they were mine. And for example, this allowed me to know that when I was at 200 milliwatts, I crossed the pond. My droopy dashes were picked up in Nova Scotia by a grabber operator there named Vernon, and he sent a real nice screenshot of the signals arriving. So I've not only crossed the Alps with these signals, but at the 200 milliwatt level, I was also able to cross the mighty Atlantic, which is, of course, very, very pleasing. I'm sure it'll happen also with the 50 milliwatt signal, but the droopy dashes, guys, they had to go. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, I'm sure almost all of you were kind of brought up in ham radio with the ethos of the need for a clean signal, and that the radio, the purity of the ham radio operator's signal was almost a sign of character, and a bad signal, chirp or clicks or splatter. Well, these are the calling cards of electromagnetic disrepute. So the droopy dashes and the key clicks had to go, and this provides an opportunity where for QRSS to be not only kind of an interesting kind of computer software intensive activity. On the transmit side, it's really not. It's very QRP, very simple circuits, very hands-on, very get out the soldering iron and fix that transmitter kind of thing. I did a couple things to get rid of my droopy dashes and my key clicks. I worked on the I did the standard work with the RC elements to shape the keying envelope, both on key down and key up, and that's pretty standard stuff that you do with any CW transmitter. I also knew that I had far too large of a coupling capacitor between the oscillator and the first RF amp. I don't even really have a buffer amp in there. It goes right into a Class A RF amp. So I decreased the size of the capacitor linking the oscillator to the first amp. And that seems to have decreased the chirp, or gotten rid of a lot of it. It also brought my power down from 50 milliwatts, from 200 milliwatts to 50 milliwatts, a more respectable QRSS level. And what else did I do? Well, I'm running the oscillator all the time, and I'm keying the amplifier stages. That seems to help. So a combination of these things. It was very, very satisfying. I'm looking at the screen. I'm looking at my signal arriving in Belgium, and at one point the clicks and the droops got so bad that it looked like I was transmitting some strange Arabic form of Hellscriber. You know, because some guys are the QRSS signals are far more sophisticated than the one that I'm sending. I'm just sending straight, really slow CW QRSS3, they call it, where each dit is 3 seconds long, and you can see the CW painted across the grabber screen. Other guys do frequency shift keying, where on key down the frequency rises by I think they usually use 5 hertz or so. And so you see kind of what ends up being a kind of a square wave pattern going across the screen with the, I think the, where you can see the characters based on their length. Other guys have used this Hellscriber where you can actually, you know, draw characters across the screen. And Eddie, G3, ZJO, I hope I got the call right. I'll have to check. Yeah, I think that's right. Has really nice signals where you could see the suffix of his call going across the screen. Anyway, all kinds of possibilities there. Another thing I discovered was that these transmitters, the whole system, because it's so narrow band, the kind of frequency shifts, not only chirp but drift, the kind of drift that you would never even notice. And in other kinds of ham radio transmissions, become very noticeable with QRSS. And for example, I have to really watch the temperature shifts here in the shack, because I found that at first, when I would as the sun came up in Rome, and as Rome heated up, my frequency would start to drift as the temperature of the rig changed. And I've got the air conditioner running right now, and I got to watch it, because sometimes when the air conditioner kicks in, if the airflow is directed up towards the beacon box, it'll cause some pretty drastic. I'll notice on the screen that my signal is kind of drifting down, and I took a picture of this and put it up on the blog, so you'll see what I'm talking about. Some guy, I think it could be a really useful feature. it could serve as sort of a temperature readout on the. We could develop a chart and see what the temperature is in the I0N2CQR shack. But I decided that some insulation was in order. Some guys go to a lot of trouble and come up with little crystal ovens to keep the crystal and the other, I guess the other circuitry at a standard temperature all the time. For me, that seemed a bit overkill, at least where I am right now. So I did some improvisation. I have the beacon transmitter up on a wooden shelf, and I think the wood provides a pretty good insulator on the bottom. And then just to to keep the top of the transmitter from varying too much in temperature. I just put a copy of the ARRL handbook up on top of it. And all that paper, I think, adds to the insulation. So hopefully I'm not going to be drifting around too much. The my frequency is right, pretty much right in the center of the QRSS band at 140. I'm 10140 around 060 hertz. I'm encouraging other folks to get involved in this. I hear rumors that our man in Vermont, the poet laureate of ham radio, Michael Alfalfa 1 TJ, this just seems like a natural for him. And I'm hearing reports that we may be seeing his signal in the QRSS band. And this brings me to another point, guys. You know, we may be in the process here of kind of invalidating our entire April Fool's joke for this year. You recall that the April Fool's joke was that I reported that I was receiving Michael's microwatt transmission with the Zener diode, and I said that, you know, I had the Drake 2B, and I fired up the Q multiplier and tuned up my NFED wire antenna, and there he was. I was receiving Michael's signal. It seemed impossible. Well, it certainly was impossible at the time, but now, if we went QRSS, if we went really, really slow, really narrow band, I'm thinking that it's possible. I'm thinking that it's doable. So maybe that'll be the challenge for the second half of the year here, to prove the April Fool's joke to be, well, not a joke, to prove it possible. A little bit about the technology. I wanted to mention this. It's really interesting stuff. I think I have understood what the principles are here. You know, obviously, we know that there's a very important relationship between the information content and the bandwidth, and that if you're running standard CW at standard CW speeds, it's as speed increases, the bandwidth increases. You actually have to almost visualize little CW sidebands coming off. Imagine your signal being modulated by the keying. And of course, as you slow down, the bandwidth of the signal narrows, and this allows for the use of really narrow bandwidth filters. Now, in most of the systems I've been describing, the filtering is taking place. The really sharp filtering is taking place at audio levels in the sound card, because you just take the audio out of your receiver, put it into the line in on the sound card, and then the software, Argo or Spectran or whatever you're using, in effect puts sequentially very, very narrow filters all across the band that you're looking at. And so you'll see this, you'll see all the frequencies displayed, but I think in effect each one of the signals that you're looking at has come through a very, very narrow audio filter. And this allows for vast improvements in the signal-to-noise ratio. If you have a signal that would ordinarily be lost in the noise at, say, the narrowest, when you think about it, the narrowest setting on my Drake 2B is 500 hertz, and that's considered real sharp. It gets sharper if you use the Q multiplier, but without the Q multiplier, 500 hertz is the narrowest filter setting that I have on the Drake 2B, and that's considered really good for CW filtering. Well, the entire QRSS band that often displays half a dozen or a dozen signals, the entire band is only 100 hertz wide, and so you can imagine that really, really narrow filters, I imagine down to I don't know, could it be down to 1 hertz filters are being used here. And so when you narrow the filter down, you're cutting out all that unnecessary noise that otherwise would be making it through. your signal to noise ratio just improves enormously. So that's what we're working on, and I'm hoping soon to be seeing coming across my screen the call of Alpha Alpha 1, Tango Juliet, and many other U.S. calls. This is something I think we need. We need more U.S. stations on. We need more U.S. grabbers, more grabbers online, perhaps with directional antennas aimed at Europe. That'd be really great. Michael's instincts in this thing, in this area, are really good, because we exchanged some emails about this, and he said that one of his first thoughts was once he gets his beacon system or beacon transmitter going, in order to obtain really optimal temperature stability, one of the things he could do would be to bury it in the ground. And I laugh because he's not the first one to think of that. And in reading some of the discussions on the Knights group, some of those guys have, I think, gone to similar extremes. I'm not going to go that far. I think the most I might do is go out and buy a little styrofoam cooler and chop off the panels and wrap this thing in some styrofoam. Replace the ARRL handbook with something a little bit more designed for thermal stability. But Michael's instincts were definitely in the right direction there, and burying the beacon in the ground would be fun. The whole beacon thing, I'm going on at length about this thing, but it's really a lot of fun. Paolo, one of the Italian hams up in the north of Italy, who's been working on this stuff, has done some really interesting things. His entire transmitter is up on the roof, and there's a picture of it on my blog. It looks like the kind of thing that you could fit in not quite in an Altoids can, but in a small can, maybe the size of your hand. And he's got a little. It's powered by a very, very small solar panel, not much bigger. So here's one thing you could conceivably do. You could build your entire transmitter with the controller to generate the CW or the pattern, and slap a little bit of solar panel on the outside of it, and use it as the center support for your dipole, and then just string the thing up in the sun and leave it there, and have no feed line or power line coming down. The thing would be entirely self-contained, essentially, in the center insulator of the dipole. Wouldn't that be different? In other words, you'd look up there, you'd see the dipole, you'd say, okay, yeah, there's a center insulator, but there's nothing coming down from it. You don't need it, because the transmitter is in the center insulator, and the power supply is the small solar panel attached to the outside of your center insulator transmitter. I don't think Paolo has it configured quite like that, but I think he's pretty close. And it just shows you what you could do. I got into a really great Skype conversation with our man in Dubai, Ron Sparks. Ron was away from the Dubai QTH. I caught up with him in Amsterdam. He was en route back to the U.S. to go to field day. This is a dedicated radio amateur. He was going back to Texas to spend field day with his ham radio buddies back there. And so three cheers to Ron for real dedication to the ham spirit. But I caught him when he was in Amsterdam. He was coping with jet lag and trying to get time adjusted to the States. And we had a really, really good QSO on, not on Echolink this time, but on Skype, full duplex. And we started talking about this. And, you know, Ron is a balloon enthusiast. He's a ham radio balloon guy, something I've always wanted to get into. And he immediately started thinking about the balloon applications for a little QRSS self-contained transmitter. So we might have out of Texas, out of the Houston area, a QRSS beacon aloft. That would be really good. Let's see. A couple other things I wanted to mention. Oh well, some good stuff here. I told you I'm still reading the Well, there's so much information here. You could be reading this thing for, you could just kind of be picking through it for a long time. But I'm still looking at Adrian Weiss's book, History of QRP in the U.S., 1924-1960, a real classic, something that deserves to be a cult classic. And Adrian's got just so much information packed in here. I spotted something that I think, I don't know if he realized this when he wrote it, but I think I've spotted kind of an interesting little kind of footnote to ham radio history here. I'm looking at the book. I'm on page 88, and it's chapter 5, Exiled to Foreign Parts, IARU reports. These are reports that appeared in the ham radio magazines about the activities of hams. I guess we're in the 1920s here still, I think. Yeah, it looks like 1920-ish. But 20s, maybe the 30s. But from the Pacific, it says here, there's just entries about what was being reported by different radio amateurs from around the world. And there's a line here. It's on the bottom of page 87, top of page 88. It says, "And from the Philippines, we learn that Elser of PI-3AA has just worked G5HA when the latter was using an input of only 5.4 watts. That name jumped out. Elser. Elser in the Philippines. Gentlemen, I think we're talking about Colonel Elser, one of the creators of the Elser Mathis Cup. Longtime listeners of Solder Smoke will know what I'm talking about here. This is the trophy, the unclaimed trophy that currently sits in ARRL headquarters in Newington, Connecticut, waiting to be claimed by the first radio amateur to establish two-way radio communication with a radio amateur on the planet Mars. No kidding. I'm not kidding here, guys. You think this is... It's not April 1st. This is for real. We've talked about this before. You can Google it. Elser Mathis Cup Mars. There it is. You'll see it. Elser was in the Philippines with U.S. military forces, was a radio amateur, and got together with another American ham named Mathis. They started talking about Mars, as you do, and they decided that they needed to have a prize established. It may have been in the spirit of the spirit of St. Louis. The prize was seen as something that drove technological innovation. Well, I don't know if this was before that or after that, but anyway, these guys had specially carved in the Philippines this cup. It's really beautiful, and they proposed that it be presented to the first ham to have this kind of cue. So anyway, I was pleased to come along. It has to be him, Elser in the Philippines, absolutely. So I don't know if Adrian knew that when he wrote it, or if anybody else has spotted it, but there we have a report from Colonel Elser. And almost at QRP levels. Unfortunately, the other guy was at 5.4 watts. So it doesn't really count. But anyway, close. And I was pleased to see him in there. You guys should do whatever you can to get a copy of this book. It belongs on the shelves of all NAC victims everywhere. Happy day yesterday, a really happy day. I went out to the mailbox, and there it was, issue number 135 of Sprat, the summer 2008 edition, with somebody we know, Dominic Baines, M1KTA, on an expedition to Mauritius. There it is, with a very fine business QSL card from a really exotic location. Fine business there, Dom, and good to see you there from Mauritius. Anyway, let me just take a look through this issue of Sprat, so that you guys can know, who haven't received it yet, can know what you're what you can look forward to. And those of you who don't get it will will know what you're missing and hopefully be inclined to get in touch with the membership folks of the GQRP Club. George Dobbs, G3RJV, reports that by the time the next issue of Sprat arrives, he'll have moved. He's retiring and moving to a new location after 24 years in the same QTH. George, good luck to you on the move. We hope you get a very fine business shack set up at the new location. Our sympathies are with you. I move more frequently than that. It's not easy, but once you get settled and once you get the soldering iron and the oscilloscope hooked up at the new location, I'm sure everything will be fine. So we look forward to seeing reports from you from the new QTH. Good luck. There's a really nice article on the first article by Mike G0CVZ on the DDS-60 direct digital synthesizer. A very small little rig there that promises to be a signal generator or a VFO for 162.6 meters. Very fine business, a very useful piece of gear. Then a really interesting article by Klaus, Delta Hotel 3 Fox Alpha Alpha, on an all-continents one-tube shortwave receiver operating on 12 volts and matched for a 32-ohm headphones. Those of you who every once in a while, like I do, get the urge to work with tube gear, I'm often dissuaded these days because after you work on the transistor gear for a while, you develop safety habits that would be completely inappropriate for tubes, like working on the equipment when it's energized. And I think it's kind of dangerous to switch back and forth between the two technologies. So I have, for a number of reasons, moved away from the fire bottles. But this project looks really interesting because it's a chance to work on the tube technology, but at 12 volts. You can't hurt yourself with 12 volts, but you really have to work at it. So this is a cool rig. It's a little one-tube regen receiver. Promises great performance. Kits are available, and it uses a, what's the tube? A 12SH1L. Apparently you can pick them up on eBay. And it looks like a really neat little rig. 12 volts, great. Experimental crystal radio article by DK2RS. A 160-meter linear amplifier using an IRF-510 by Peter G4UMB. A low-cost full QSK TR switcher and sequencer by Gert Papa Alpha 3 Charlie Radio Charlie. Sad note on the passing away of Derry, a VE7QK. One of the originators of the Epiphyte transceiver series, the SSB transceiver that caused the eye of so many of us a few years ago. Sorry to hear of Derry's passing. Then there's a wideband active receiving loop antenna by original design by John G8CQX, and the article is by Des Mike Zero Alpha Yankee Foxtrot. Very fine. I always love the diagrams in Sprat. A hand crank generator power supply, part two, by Mitchell Lee, KB6FPW. This is how to make use of those wind-up radio devices that you see all the time. Very interesting. A Miser's surface mount measuring tweezers by Steve, G0XAR. And a nice article on fitting standard knobs to polyvaricon capacitors. We've all had this problem, and Barry G8RIW gives us a solution. There's a USB-controlled synthesizer for the soft rock rig by Jan G0BBL. And an article on a different type of QRP up in the gigahertz range by Richard G3CWI. Dave Smith, David Smith, G4COE, gives a very, very useful thing here. I'm going to copy it out and put it up on the wall of the shack here. It's a toroidal inductance chart. No longer will you have to search around for the formula and try to figure out how many turns. There it is, a really nice chart showing the number of turns for different toroidal cores, their colors, and what the resulting inductance value in microhenries will be. Very fine, very useful. Thanks, David. There's a report on Dominic's QRPD expedition to Mauritius. A good article of always in the antenna anecdotes and awards section by Colin G3VTT. And let's see. And then we're getting towards the communications and contact section by Peter G3XJS. And finally, one of my favorite sections of the magazine by Members News by Chris Page G4BUE. I love this section. I forgot to send him an entry. I think I was too caught up in the QRSS world, but anyway, then on the back page, GQRP Club sales, all the good devices that that the good guys at GQRP Club make available to all of us. Fine business. Thanks to everybody who works on that that magazine, Sprat, the Journal of the GQRP Club, devoted to low power communications. If you're not signed up for it, you really should be. Excellent stuff. Okay, let's see. Before I go to the gong portion of the show, just a couple of notes here. There's been a great discussion on quartz crystals, very apropos of what we've been discussing on QRSS. Quartz crystals, their origins in Brazil, how to model them. Wes Hayward has made a really great contribution and sent a great message discussing the technical characteristics of and quartz crystals and how to model them. It's been on the EMRFD discussion group. If you want, you could check that out. It's really interesting. I've added some pictures to the solder slides on the blog page. You can click on the solder slides slideshow and take a look at them. And I'm adding captions, so I thought you guys might be interested in that. And, the cluster map. I was sitting here the other day, and I pulled up the cluster map, and Billy, perhaps revealing that he is sort of a knack victim himself, he said, "Hey, Dad, looks like you've got all the continents." So I said, yeah, worked all continents on the cluster map. The cluster map just displays where... This displays the locations of people who've been looking at the blog website. We have one up for the Solder Smoke podcast page, but this one handles the viewers of the blog page. And there's been some recent additions. We have people reading the blog in Vietnam, Thailand, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela. Somebody up, it must be the Shetland Islands. There's a red dot up there north of Great Britain. And I'm thinking that must be somebody out in the Shetland or the Orkney Islands out there. Let me know who that is. We've got more dots in China. Russia is a dot in Zimbabwe. So we're glad to see all those dots there. And if you're the person or persons responsible for them, please send us a report, send us an email, and let us know what you're working on. Guys, that brings us to...
It's time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love it.
Indeed.
Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. A lot of good mail coming in. We got an email from Steve, G0FUW, our man in Bath. He reports that Eamon Skelton... EI9GQ is a confirmed knack victim. Eamon has an article on homebrew amps in the latest edition of Radcom, and he was describing some of his work on the amplifiers using FETs. And here's a quote from the article. Eamon writes, "In the interest of science, I put on my safety goggles, wound the drive up to 20 watts, and gave the amp a sustained single-tone whistle. The meter was showing over 500 watts when the FETs exploded. All right. Yes, that is a symptom of the knack. When you say, I wonder what it'll do. I wonder if this thing will do 500 watts. And kablam, man. It just conjured up all kinds of images of Gene Shepherd's basement. Yeah. Yeah, old man Echo India 9 GQ. Confirmed case of the knack. All right. Thanks for sharing that with us, Steve. And Eamon, thanks for the article. I haven't seen it, but I liked reading the excerpt. Got some a thoughtful set of emails from Rick, KC, Kilo Charlie Zero, Papa Echo Tango. And he was discussing the struggles that many of us have to understand the principles behind the circuitry that we're working on, or the devices we're working on, or the principles of physics behind all this knack stuff. And Rick, I think, makes a really good point that every once in a while you just have to kind of stop scratching your head and say, you know, I'm going to leave this for a while. I'm going to move on and maybe go back later on and see if I can deepen my understanding of it. I think that's really true. I think that's a good approach to take, Rick. And I also think it's helpful sometimes, although it's painful to admit, that there are kind of limits to the understanding of the deepest of this stuff at the deepest level. I mean, as a kid, I was always really trying to understand all about it. I mean, I felt like if I didn't really understand completely what was going on in a bit of circuitry, or what the electrons were doing, or how they were moving, or what they were, then I wouldn't really be a true radio amateur. But years later, reading Richard Feynman's stuff, one of the great things about Feynman's writing is that he admits that at a basic level, he doesn't even understand some of the quantum stuff that he won the Nobel Prize for. So I guess there are limits out there. We have to recognize them, and every once in a while put something up on the shelf and say, hey, look, I'm going to think about that some more later on. I was also reminded of comments by Doug DeMaw, one of the masters, and I think in the preface to his either QRP notebook or design notebook, he admits that occasionally he built something and used it and didn't completely understand how the circuit worked. So if Doug DeMaw can do it, we can do it too. So thanks for that, Rick. A very thoughtful email exchange. Bill ON4AW sent a very fine business webpage with ham radio art and pictures. I'm going to post this up on the blog here in the next few days. I've already used some of the pictures in the slideshow. There was a great picture included in some of the pages that he sent. One of them showed Marconi's apartment building, the block of flats that Marconi lived in on the Strand in London. And of course, there was some very large dipole antennas festooning the the roof area. And I wondered if Marconi had problems with the neighbors. If you're the first one putting up antennas like that, perhaps they didn't even realize what was going on and didn't know to object. But he had some very, very interesting antennas up there. It's in the slideshow section of the Blogspot, soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, so you can check that out. And Bill, thanks for sending those along. Dave, KG6TCJ, came in right about the same time that I figured out how to use Argo and use the spectrum analysis software for QRSS calibration. Dave sent in that suggestion. A good one, Dave, and thanks for that. Russ, W4NI, wrote in on with a question about, and it's a good question. I'll throw it out to the group. For those of us who don't have sophisticated spectrum analyzers, what's the best way to measure the level of harmonic output from our transmitters? Good question. I know I don't know if they still are, but British radio amateurs were all required to have in the shack a tunable, what they used to call absorption wave meter. I've heard differing views on how effective these things were in really coming up with a quantitative measure of harmonic output. Some say they were useful, some say they weren't. I throw that out to the group, and if anybody's got a good answer for Russ, send it my way, and we'll pass it on or talk about it here on the show. Niels, PE1OIT, continues to send in really interesting email, and he came in with a really interesting solution to my very highly accurate my need for really high accuracy in calibrating rigs. Wes also sent me some really useful stuff on how to use dividers, divider circuitry, frequency divider circuitry, to come up with a good frequency standard. Niels has a technique that's being used by a number of people in the QRSS community, and that's to use a GPS-disciplined frequency counter, to use the very accurate information coming down from the GPS satellites to come up with a frequency counter that is essentially calibrated to very, very high accuracy and kept in calibration by signals from the GPS system. I think that's a really interesting technique. It may be one of those things that I'd like to do, but it may be beyond my capabilities at this point. So I think I'm just, one of the things that I've done with the QRSS system is, once I have the signal in the band, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and I leave it in there, and I can retune it a little bit with the Argo system, but I don't want to go too far, because if I get out, I might have to go through the same agony to get back in. Guys, I'm looking at the chart, and we're about at the 57-minute portion, which means it's time for me to wrap this one up. The kids will be waking up soon, and we'll have another series of, I don't know what we're going to do today, but something fun. Thanks for listening. Have a good week, and I hope that today's discussion will cause more of you to get involved in the fascinating world of QRSS, low-speed CW. I hope everybody had a great 4th of July. A belated happy 4th to all my fellow Americans out there, and hope it's hope the summer's going well for you, and I also hope everybody had a good field day. Yeah. We got some interesting reports on field day. Wes sent me a nice report on his field day activities. That was really great to see and read. And have a great summer ahead. And I think I'll be able to continue to put out Solder Smoke here every couple of weeks for the rest of the summer. We'll time it when we go away. Well, I might miss one, but. There won't be any big. You won't have to go to reruns for the summer for Solder Smoke. Put it that way. 7-3 from Rome.